Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and today we're going to zero in on, well, we're going to talk about weeds, we're going to talk about prairies, we're going to talk about pollinator plants, all kinds of things to talk about today with our guest Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield. And he'll be taking your questions, of course, on a whole variety of topics, the ones I just talked about primarily. But maybe you have some stubborn weeds in your garden. Maybe you're interested in plants to attract bees and butterflies. And Neil thinks we also ought to be trying to attract parasitic wasps. And we'll get some more information from him on that as we move along today. In the meantime, if you have a question for Neil, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show. And Neil DeBull, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be with you again.
How bad of a problem can lawn and prairie and garden weeds be at this time of the year?
Well, this is when you start to see the weeds raise their ugly heads. And weeds are inevitable. I guess they're like death and taxes.
Yeah.
They're going to be there no matter what you do. And most of our weeds are imported, non-native weeds that were brought over from Europe, Asia, etc., many of which have made themselves very much at home. And actually, we do have a few native plants that can be really problematic in our prairies as well. So we can talk about different strategies for controlling these plants. We can talk about how to do it organically. We can talk how you can use selective herbicides if necessary. The only time you'd really want to use herbicides or have to use herbicides is when you're dealing with intractable perennial weeds, particularly perennial rhizomatous weeds like Canada goldenrod, which is a native plant, Canada thistle, field bindweed, etc. There's some really nasty ones.
Yeah.
So, but most of the time you can control most weeds without resorting to herbicides. Yeah. And there's a variety of strategies that can be used to do that.
Well, give me one.
Well, when we start a prairie, like if we're talking about seeding a prairie where you have a larger area, it's kind of a war out there. And there's all these dormant seeds in the soil that are going to germinate and compete with your plants. Hopefully, you've done good site preparation because you really need to eliminate all the perennial weeds on the site well in advance of seeding. That can take up to a year, maybe even 2 years, depending upon the severity of infestation that you're starting with. So if you've eliminated all the weeds, now the dormant seeds start to germinate after you put your seeds in, and they start coming up in the spring, summer. And typically in the first year, a seeded prairie will be dominated by annual weeds like foxtail.
Yeah.
And pigweed.
Pigweed, yeah.
Lamb's quarters, ragweed, things like this. Well, these are relatively easy to control. And most of your prairie seedlings in the first year will not get taller than 6 inches. So we just keep the weeds mowed back to 6 inches. So when the weeds get up to about a foot as the season progresses, we knock them back to 6 inches. And you can do this on a small area with a weed whacker. On a larger area, you'll need a mower that can get up to 6 inches. Most typical lawnmowers will only go to about four.
Four.
Yeah. And you can mow at 4 inches in the first few months of a first year prairie seeding, but the prairie plants will start to exceed 4 inches in height, and you really don't want to chop them off, so you need to raise the mower up to 6 inches, usually around July 4th. So you would expect to mow a newly seeded prairie in the first year 3 to 4 times at 6 inches, never letting the weeds get more than 12 inches tall, because if you mow more than 6 inches of weeds off, it can be a fairly significant amount of cut material that can bury your young seedlings.
Yeah. Well, now, tell me again, how do you get, if you've got a regular lawnmower, how do you get up 6 inches?
Well, you can put larger wheels on
that. That's what I was thinking. I was going to mention that, but I thought, oh, man, that's a...
That's really the only way to do it. So, yeah, and you can buy larger wheels, and you can usually, it's just a bolt that you take off of the existing wheels.
It's not that hard.
Yeah, it's not that hard. So if you don't have that option, a weed whacker is fine, or you can go out with a hand scythe. I have a little old-fashioned hand scythe, and it's got about a 16-inch length cutting blade on it, and it's just with the handle, and you go out there and get your exercise. Or you can use a gasoline weed whacker, which goes a little bit faster, but not that much, and it makes a lot more noise, and you mix the oil with the gas, and it kind of smells bad. So,
well, and you've gotten me pretty good with that scythe.
Oh,
you get
the hang of it.
I hear tell.
Yeah. Now, that's not the kind that you see people reaping grain with a big, long blade. I tried that once, And I realized, this is not for amateurs like me.
This is not for Neil.
So this is just a single handle hand scythe. You can get them for like $20 at the garden center or the hardware store. And they work quite well. So that's what you can use on a small area. But on a large area, you would need some kind of a tractor-mounted mower that you can lift up.
Can you actually... Well, I assume you should be able to find tires that are big enough.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can find them. With the internet, you can find anything.
Neil DePohl, our guest today. Questions for him. Talking prairies today. We're talking dealing with weeds. We're talking about pollinator plants as part of prairies and part of other areas as well. Give a call, 1-800-642-1234. Let's see. Joya in Fitchburg. Let's go to you. Hi, Joya.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call, Larry.
Sure.
I got two questions for him. One is the cardinal plant, which is a butterfly, you know, attractor. And I have tried 2 years with the cardinal plant, and I have not been successful. And is there any particular kind of a soil it needs?
Yes. First of all, are you using seeds or plants?
No, actual plant.
Okay. A cardinal flower needs a rich, moist soil in order to do well. Its natural habitat normally is in along stream sides, stream banks, in partial shade, in rich, organic, usually organic soil with plenty of moisture. So it does not like dry sites. If you put it in a dry soil in full sun, it's probably going to shrivel up and die. So you want to make sure you have it in the right situation. And another thing about the cardinal flower is it is a short-lived perennial. It usually only lives about 3 years. And people often will call us and say, oh, I killed my cardinal flower. Well, no, you didn't kill your cardinal flower. It committed suicide because it's a short-lived plant. And it only has usually about a three-year lifespan.
So then after 2 years, does it come back?
No, that's its life cycle. So it usually,
so it lives only for 3 years.
Generally speaking, yes, it's rare.
Well, then maybe it had its life cycle because it was 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And so probably another question I have is I found in the Arboretum plant sale this year a new plant called rose melon. Apparently, it's a hibiscus family.
Yes.
Where can I find it?
Well, actually, we sell rose mallow at Prairie Nursery, so you can call us. And the last time I checked our inventory, we have a little over 100 plants left. So,
but is it you sell the seeds or you sell the actual plants?
Oh, we only sell the plants. Yes.
Oh, you only sell the plants.
Yes.
Okay.
And you sell, and you can
order to you, then I can get it.
Yes, if you can call us, I can give you our
Give the number.
Yeah, you can call us at 1-800-476.
I have your catalog from 2 years ago.
Okay, same number.
1-800-476-9453.
1-800-GROW-WILD.
Oh, that's what it is.
And you can also, of course, go online and order online at our website, www.prairienursery.com. Prairienursery.com.
There we go. Thanks so much, Joya, for calling. Appreciate your call. And, you know, if they only last 3 years, those cardinal. Why
would you plant them?
Why would you plant them?
Because they're absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
And they are irresistible to hummingbirds.
Okay.
So, you know, some plants will self-sow naturally. Cardinal flower...
Not so much.
It needs very, very specific growing conditions, and it typically does not make itself at home in a garden. Every once in a while, you may have the right conditions, or you just get lucky, and it will proliferate. It does need open soil, and it needs a rich, usually pretty heavy organic soil, lots of good compost or rich soil.
Kevin in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Kevin. Thank you for calling. No, guess we lost Kevin. Let's go to David in Menominee next. David, hello.
Hi there. I have a question. I put in 3 acres of pollinator habitat through a program with NRCS last year. This year should be the first big growing year, and there is tons of yellow mustard up, somewhere around, you know, anywhere between 12 and 18 inches tall. We started pulling it, and... It's a huge amount of work.
No, that's not the way to go.
was wondering if we should leave it, or because it is has pretty yellow flowers on it. It's not garlic mustard. It's the other mustards.
Yeah.
But I've called a few prairie people, and nobody can give me a definitive answer as to if I should just leave it or what to do about it.
Okay.
Kevin, you're calling the wrong prairie people. Oh, David, you're calling the wrong prairie people. This is pretty easy to handle because the mustards, most of your mustards are annuals, not all, but most. And the yellow mustard, I think you're probably talking about yellow rocket. And that's a very common fall germinating mustard. And a vast majority of the mustards that you will see germinate in the fall. And you seeded this in the fall, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So this mustard actually germinated last fall. It will germinate quite late, and it forms a small basal rosette, and then in the spring, it goes crazy.
Right.
And it grows like a bandit, okay? First and foremost, never, ever, ever pull weeds in a first-year prairie seeding, because when you pull those weeds, you're going to pull up your prairie seedlings with it, and you'll have nothing left.
Okay,
because the prairie seedlings grow very slowly, and you won't even see them when they're young. And up they come, and now you've got a big open hole, and the only thing you'll get there is going to be weeds. So how do we handle this? The only way to handle it is to mow it. And so when the weeds, like this yellow mustard, get to about a foot tall, you mow them down to 6. This early in the season, you could mow it down to about 3, because none of your prairie seedlings are probably taller than 3 inches yet, because they just germinated recently. The problem, if this is yellow rocket, is that it has spreading basal leaves, which tend to shade things out. And that does make it much more difficult than some of your more upright weeds, like grasses, which don't have big spreading leaves at the base. And those spreading leaves, if they're really thick, can actually shade out the seedlings. So that could be a problem. But at least you can prevent it from growing any taller by keeping it mowed back 3 to 4 inches now, and then raise your mower up to about 6 inches when you get into early summer around July 4th.
Okay. And should I, considering this is kind of the second year, but not really, because there was some growth last year, should I mow 2 or 3 times this summer?
Yes, you will probably be mowing. Normally, we mow 3 times in the first growing season. It does depend upon the rainfall and your soil type. If you have a rich soil, and it sounds like, I'm going to guess you have a pretty rich soil if you have yellow rocket. Is that correct?
We do.
Yeah, okay. So you're going to want to mow this, I'm going to guess, 3 to 4 times. If it really rains a lot and you have such rich soil, you might actually be up to 5 times. But make sure that you don't let the weeds get taller than 12 inches before you mow, so you do not have excessive amounts of cut material. Good luck.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Penny in Cedarburg next. Hi, Penny.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about the wildflower milkweed. I have heard that, you know, there's kind of iffy that it's dying out in areas because of just fielding people, you know, planting fields, and that we should allow it to grow if we can. So I have it in my cottage garden, and I usually weed it down to maybe about 6 or 7 or 8 plants. I love it. It's beautiful. But what I'm finding now is it's killing off the perennials that it comes up around. So I kind of feel bad about yanking it out. I mean, is that kind of common for milkweed to kill what it's growing near?
Well, I'm assuming you have common milkweed. There are many different milkweeds. This is the common milkweed that forms patches and has lavender.
Exactly.
Yep, and sweet-sided flowers. Mm-hmm. Yes, okay. Common milkweed creeps by rhizomes, and this is a weed that, you know, people call it a weed. I mean, that's where it got its name. And that's because of its behavior. So agriculturally, it's been considered a weed. For the monarch butterfly, it's a lifeline to their existence. So what to do in your situation? There's nothing wrong with adjusting the populations of the plants in the garden. And so I think what you're doing is perfectly fine. The main thing is that if you want to create a home for monarch butterflies, that you at least leave a reasonable amount of the common milkweed. Normally, when I work, I don't usually put common milkweed in a garden because of its behavioral issues. Okay? It's great in a prairie meadow, a large prairie meadow, where it's in competition with other flowers and grasses. There, it's a little bit more compatible. In a garden, it has room to run, and it can get out of control. So, but if you want the common milkweed in your garden, you can just adjust it by, you know, pulling some of the plants out. You won't actually pull the entire plant out, because when you pull it, you notice that you get this white rhizome that breaks off, and you never
actually... Sometimes I'll get the whole root.
Wow.
Do it just right.
Wow, you're good.
After
it's rain, you know, you got to be careful, though.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. After rain, you can get a larger part of the rhizome. So... But usually there's rhizome remaining, and the plants will resprout. It's quite a competitor, but it's a very important plant, obviously, for the monarch. So you can just remove the plants that you don't want in certain areas and then encourage it in other areas where you have room for it to run.
Yeah, there we go.
Well, that explains it, why it's killed off some. So I'll just keep doing what I'm doing and pull it out of certain areas I don't want it to kill.
It sounds like
you're on. Thank you so much.
You bet. Yeah. Sounds good, Penny.
Thanks a lot, Penny, for calling. Appreciate it. Neil DeBow, president of Prairie Nursery of Westfield, Wisconsin. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. Chris Molina, our on-air producer, here for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Next week on Garden Talk, UW Extension Horticulture and Ag Agent Scott Royce talks with us about all things in the garden, so looking forward to that. Taking a look at prairies today with our guest Neil DeBow, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield. We've talked a bit about weeds. We've talked about pollinators a little bit, but you can join in too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. And Sally in Sparta is up next. Hi, Sally.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is about creeping Charlie. The only way I can get rid of it is to sit down and just pull it out. And then I put it in the fire pit, because if I throw it somewhere, then it grows there. And I will take my answer off air. Thank you very much.
Creeping Charlie. Oh, boy. Yeah, this is a real problem. This is a rhizomatous member of the mint family that creeps and crawls all over the place, spreads like wildfire. The seeds stay dormant in the soil, and even after you think you've eliminated it, assuming that you've removed every single rhizome, which is usually a pipe dream,
yep,
because it's so hard to get it all, then the dormant seeds in the soil will germinate, and it magically reappears. I do the same thing in my vegetable garden because I don't use any pesticides in my vegetable garden. So it creeps in from the edge. I have a no-mow lawn around the edge, but right at the edge,
yeah,
where the grass isn't thick, then the creeping Charlie creeps in. It has a little habitat right on the edge. In the lawn, in my no-mow lawn where I don't mow it, I have no creeping Charlie because the grass buries it. So if you mow your lawn, you will get creeping Charlie. You will get dandelions. You will get all sorts of plants that need light at the soil surface, and you're providing perfect habitat by mowing it back to allow it to grow there. If you stop mowing your lawn, the grasses will grow stronger and taller and higher, and they will typically squeeze a lot of these weeds out, like chickweed is another one. So you're just depriving creeping Charlie and other low-growing weeds of light by letting the grasses grow taller. So that's a very easy organic method, assuming you're in an area where you can let your lawn grow. And mm-hmm. I live in the country, so I don't care what anybody thinks. Yeah, hey, it's my place. Go away. Don't tell me what to do with my lawn. But to get rid of creeping Charlie, it's really, really, really tough. You can pull it by hand, but it comes right back. If you don't have a situation where you can outcompete it, and if you plant a prairie, for instance, the prairie plants will completely eliminate it just by virtue of their root systems, their extensive root systems, and their taller stature. However, if it's in a garden-type situation, some people will resort to a broadleaf herbicide to kill it. And you have to be selective because there are certain herbicides that will kill creeping Charlie and certain ones that won't. I'm not a big fan of that. That's why I pull it out by hand. In my shade garden, it gets into my shade garden. And even if you mulch it, it will creep right up through the mulch. So that's no defense against it. So I plant lots of plants with broad spreading leaves that can deprive it of sunlight. So I'm just using natural plant material to overcome the creeping Charlie by depriving it of light and thus depriving it of habitat. So that's an easy way to do it in a garden situation, is to plant broad spreading plants that have lots of leaves that can shade the ground where the creeping Charlie grows. So those are basically the three ways to handle it. It's a tough one.
Yeah, it definitely is. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling, Sally. Barb in Nakusa, let's go to you next. Hi, Barb.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have daisies, and I assume they're wild, coming up all over in all my flower beds. And I heard that they put out a poison, and I'm worried they're going to kill my other perennials. Is that true?
Yes, they're white daisies, and they have flowers about 2 inches in diameter.
Yep.
With a little yellow center. Yes, Leucanthemum, formerly known as Chrysanthemum Leucanthemum. They keep changing the names to keep you on your toes. This is in a group of plants in the aster family that are notorious for using chemical warfare against other plants. And this is what is referred to as an allelopathic plant, A-L-L-E-L-O-P-A-T-H-I-C, allelopathic. And the plants actually exude plant herbicides natural herbicides through their roots to discourage the growth of other plants nearby. So that's why you'll often see the white daisies in very large patches, often not necessarily to the exclusion of other plants, but with a lower diversity of other plants, usually just some grass around them. So, yeah, they can take over. They don't so much creep as they spread by seed, but it can become more abundant over time if you allow them to seed into the area.
Okay, so I need to take them all out.
Well, that's up to you. If they're in an area where you want something else to grow, then yes, you would want to remove them. I kind of like them, but it was, if they're in my prairie, I'm not real excited about them. But the prairie plants will usually, over time, outcompete them simply because most prairie plants are taller and more competitive over the long term. But in some garden situations where you have open soil or in a mowed lawn situation, the daisies can become more abundant.
There we go.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Neil, talk a little bit. I mean, when we talk about prairies, you have a pretty broad definition, at least in terms of sizes of, you know, people can have a little prairie kind of in their lawn area if they want.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can have a small little prairie garden. Most people will start a prairie garden from transplants. And you can have a big, large prairie of a quarter acre, an acre, 10 acres, 100 acres, depending on the size of property you have and what your landscape goals are. And in many cases, people will plant large areas of prairie for habitat as well. So for the average homeowner, you can put in a beautiful prairie garden. And really, it's no different from a perennial garden. You can use the same design characteristics, same design parameters, by looking at the characteristics of the plants, the bloom times, the heights, the textures, the leaves, flower color, and you can associate different flowers with one another that bloom at the same time for nice color combinations. So I can create a beautiful English garden for you using all native prairie plants. And in fact, the English were using our prairie plants 200 years ago while we were busy plowing them up.
Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As a friend of mine says, you know, we take your plants and we give them names and we send them back to you. So we viewed them as weeds because they were in the way of agriculture because we plowed up the prairies because the soils were so incredibly productive. But the English saw these as just another wonderful set of plants, which they, of course, collected from all around the world and incorporated them into their gardens. So you can create beautiful, beautiful gardens, even on a very small scale, using these plants. And a lot of people will create like kidney gardens or some drift gardens through their lawn. And you can put that in your front yard and have a beautiful garden, and people won't know that these are "quote unquote" native weeds, which they used to, when I 35 years ago, all these plants that I sold were considered weeds. Of course, now they're not because people have learned how beautiful they are. But you can create wonderful gardens of very small scale, and you can create larger gardens. What a lot of our customers do is they don't want too much lawn, but what you can do is you can retain part of the lawn and create different gardens within the lawn and retain the lawn for pathways through it, and allows you to phase in plantings over time. So one year you'll put in one garden, and next year you'll put in another garden, and just slowly convert portions of your lawn, but leave some structure or some pathways of lawn there so it looks more well kept. And stick with the lower growing plants, the plants that grow 1 to 3 or 4 feet tall, not the big giant guys that are 6, 8, 10 feet tall. And people find that much more appealing, and it's more conforms better to our concept of what is a more traditional garden.
Yeah, those are good ideas. Kevin in Madison has a question, so let's go there. Kevin, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I'm literally in the middle of it here in my timber. I just bought a property here in Madison, and I've got this, moved here from Iowa, I've got this monstrous vine that's growing everywhere. It seems to be strangling some of these trees, and it's really quite prolific. You can barely walk in some of these areas. I'm just wondering, how do I identify it?
Oh, boy.
It's not a small, I mean, there are small vines, but like right now I'm right at the base of what looks like a mother of vines, and it's probably 4 inches around.
Okay, it's a woody vine?
Yes.
Okay, it's 4 inches around.
Have you got a smartphone, you could take a picture of it and put it up on our Facebook page, Kevin?
Yes.
Yes, if you could get a picture of the stem and the leaves, a close-up of the leaves. I'm assuming it's not blooming yet. Is that correct, Kevin?
No, okay. But it is thick here. I guess I would describe the leaf. The leaf of it is not round. It's almost, I guess it's fairly close to rounded, and then it tapers to a more of a pear shape at the bottom. The outside of the leaf is fairly round.
How far up in the tree does it grow?
Oh, there's some trees here. It's 60-foot tall.
Okay. If you could send a picture of the leaf and then the base of the plant so we can see what the bark looks like on it, we might be able to get a little closer. There are a number of different candidates for that.
There are? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I've never seen anything like it before. I mean, Tarzan could live in this.
Oh, boy.
It's amazing.
Okay, but it's a single... It's not... It's,
pardon me?
The leaf is not cut. It's not it's not indented. It's more round.
No.
All right.
Okay, and it doesn't, and hopefully it does not have leaves of three, right?
No,
okay,
no, it's
good.
Not a poison. I'd be covered with it if it was.
Okay, good. Just making sure before you do anything else with that. So, yeah, if you send a photo, we can take a look at that and see if we can't diagnose it.
Yeah, put it up. Take a photo and put it up on our Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mealer Show. That's the title of our Facebook page. And post it, and before the show's over, we'll get a look at it, and Neil will probably come up with an answer for you.
Yeah. Well, one can only hope.
One can only hope. All right. Go ahead and do that, Kevin. Thanks a lot for calling. In the meantime, we'll turn to Betty in Chippewa Falls. Betty, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry and Neil. Thank you for taking my call. I'm so excited to get a chance to have Neil give me some advice. I have large perennial beds, and last year I found that violets were just becoming prolific in one of the beds. Now they're in my lawn. How do I get rid of them besides pulling? Is that my only option?
Well, violets, yes.
Yeah.
They're a love-hate relationship.
Yes.
I have violets all over my lawn in shaded areas.
Yeah.
And I love them. They are such a wonderful harbinger of spring. And I enjoy them, but I'm not, you know, I don't have a golf course lawn, so I let all kinds of critters come into my lawn. But basically...
Well, I don't mind them in the lawn, but in my perennial beds, I kind of do mind them.
Yeah. Are they competing with your other plants, or are they just prolific?
Yes, they're surrounding, going in between plants.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Violets, depending on the species, they can expand out from their base to spread, and then of course they produce copious quantities of seeds, and the violet seeds disperse themselves with exploding pods. And so the seeds explode and they can shoot all over the place, so they are able to really spread around 10-15 feet with these exploding pods. So what to do? You can prevent germination of the seeds by mulching your beds heavily. This will not stop established plants because they can creep up through the mulch. But you can at least prevent further infestation by mulching like 3 inches of mulch over the soil so that the seeds cannot germinate. The existing violets, if I have violets somewhere where I don't want them, you can pull them out, but you do have to make sure you get all the roots. You want to have some kind of a digging tool to get them out with to make sure you get all of the root. And you'll see they're usually in big clumps. And each, you can divide them and get more violets if you want. But you probably don't want to do that. Okay. So once you've eliminated all the existing violets, then you can put mulch over it. Or you can, if you so desire, just mulch over them. And then the ones that start to come up through that sometimes are easier to pull up through the mulch. So it's less work. You will be able to kill some with the mulch, but some will certainly come up through that. So that's another strategy. But the main thing here is to stop the cycle of seeding. And the way to prevent that is by mulching heavily. And then you don't have to use any herbicides.
Okay.
Yeah. There we go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Amy on Facebook writes this. We have a wooded lot that is being taken over by jewelweed. Should I pull it out, cut it, not worry about it? We're trying to plant and encourage things like woodland wildflowers, bloodroot, mayapples, wild ginger, and so on.
Well, jewelweed is a fascinating plant. There are actually two species of jewelweed in Wisconsin. There is a yellow-flowered jewelweed, which typically grows on upland, well-drained slopes in rich soils, or sites, not necessarily slopes, but upland areas. And then you have the orange jewelweed, which is a denizen of moist areas. And both of these typically will grow in shaded areas. The yellow in particular prefers shade. The orange jewelweed will grow in the full sun as well. So as far as controlling it, the jewelweed is an annual. So it has to germinate from seeds and grow every single year anew from seeds. So if you are establishing a bed of other woodland plants. You can plant them either in the fall, depending on the species. Many of the woodland plants actually do best when planted in the fall because that prepositions them for their early spring growth. They get some root development in the fall, and then they can come out of the soil better established in the spring and you get better results. So again, this is a situation where this is a plant that propagates by seed rather than by rhizomes or some other fashion. So you can control the germination of the seeds, again, with mulch. So if you put 3 inches of mulch around your plants, then you will bury those seeds. Most seeds need light in order to germinate, and you should see a great reduction in the frequency of the jewelweed seeds. Now, one thing about jewelweed to remember is that, yes, it can be a pest, and I swear this plant must use chemical warfare because I see it growing in areas where it is absolutely solid and nothing else grows there. How does it do that, especially as an annual? How does it come back year after year after year in the same place with essentially no competition? There's something magic going on here. Either it's using natural herbicides in its roots or it's aliens. I'm not sure which. I think the mulch is going to be the best way to go about this to make sure that the seeds don't germinate. And then if you do get some plants coming up through the mulch, then make sure you pull them immediately. Both of the jewelweeds that grow in Wisconsin are very, very good nectar sources for hummingbirds and other pollinators. So they're not all bad.
There we go. Let's go to Julie in Eau Claire now. Julie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, good morning. I've got my sister, this was years ago, so I don't remember how it turned out, but she had the idea to leave all this tall grass right next to around her flower bed and her veggies. Her idea was that then the insects will stay out of her flower and vegetables and stay in all that grass. I'm wondering what you think about that. And then I have like a quack grass bed at the bottom of my garden. It's a little ways from my garden. Can I leave that there as long as I don't let it go to seed?
Okay, why don't you stay on the line here so we can talk about some specifics here, Julie, if that's okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So just letting this grass grow around the garden beds, is it just grass or are there also flowering plants in there as well?
No, it's mostly, I live on a farm, and it's mostly quack grass.
Okay, I want to make sure we know what grass we're up against.
Yeah.
Well, quack grass is public enemy number 1, 2, and 3 in my book because it creeps by rhizomes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very difficult to eliminate. And if you leave it on an edge, of course, then it creeps in. And actually, I have more problem in my vegetable garden with smooth brome grass, which is an agricultural grass that was brought here intentionally for pastures and for hay fields. But both of them creep by rhizomes. They're both perennials. They're very long-lived. And quack grass can creep up to 5 feet a year in good soil in the right conditions. So, yeah, it's a real, real competitor. So leaving it on the edge is going to be a never-ending problem because it's going to creep in. Number two, most insects, especially pollinators, of course, need what we consider flowering plants. Now, grasses are flowering plants, but they don't have nectar because they are wind pollinated. So your plants that produce flowers that are insect pollinated are the ones that are going to create more habitat and be more attractive to insects. Grasses, yes, there are some insects that will eat the grass leaves and some will kind of hang out in the grass. But as far as actually supporting populations of insects, grasses are not nearly as good as quote-unquote flowering plants. So the strategy here is probably not going to yield really good results, and it's going to leave a weedy plant like quackgrass right at the edge of your garden where it's going to creep in and cause you no end of grief. So how to control quackgrass? Oh, boy. Well, you can't pull it. I've tried that. That's an exercise in futility because of the rhizomes. All you have to do is leave a 1-inch section of rhizome in the ground, and it will resprout and recolonize the area in 3 blinks of an eye. So pulling is out. The only way that you can do this organically is to till it up, dig it out. And when I say till it up, you have to repeatedly till it and expose the rhizomes to the sun over an entire growing season. So you're going to be out there tilling it like every 3 weeks and bring up the rhizomes or get some kind of a cultivator. In the old days, farmers had something called a quack digger, which is a cultivator on an eccentric gear that rips the quack grass rhizomes out of the ground. I used to use one of those because I did prairies organically 35, 40 years ago. Did not use any herbicides, and it works. If you want to go out there every 3 weeks and rip up the quack grass, you can do that all year long and you will get rid of the quack grass. Most people are not going to go get a quack digger, hook it up to their tractor, and go back and forth every 3 weeks ripping it up. The other choice is to use herbicides. If you're okay with using glyphosate, i.e. Roundup, you can spray quackgrass in the late spring once it reaches what they call the four-leaf stage, where it has four fully formed leaves coming off of the stem. You can kill 99.9% of it, or you can spray it in September. It's particularly susceptible in the fall because it's sending its energy down into the roots, and most plants are most susceptible to herbicides later in the season. So that is another option. Or you can smother it. And you have to smother it for a full growing season. So you'd want to put black plastic or burlap, you know, whatever you got, old tarps, cardboard, and smother the area from April 1st through the end of October, and that will usually eliminate it pretty much completely.
Cutting it with a corn knife, that wouldn't help.
Nope. You can cut it and cut it and cut it. Well, if you cut it repeatedly, you will eventually sap the energy from the rhizomes, but you can't let it get much more than 4 or 5 inches tall before you cut it, because it's going to then start to photosynthesize from the leaves and then replenish the roots. So the trick is to get it to generate new leaf material from its stored root reserves in the rhizomes, and then before it can replenish the roots, you cut those leaves back. But you're going to have to do that for 2 or 3 years.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a real bear. And it's really interesting. I talked to a neighbor of mine in Columbia County, and he talked about his great-great uncle who came from Scotland, and he brought seed of evergrass that he planted on the farm. And what was evergrass? Quackgrass.
Oh, boy. That's how things like that arrive. No? There we go, Julie. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have a photo up on our Facebook page, and I'll have Neil take a look at that in a minute, but let's go to Wayne in New Berlin next. Wayne, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there, guys. I've got some new weed in my garden that I've never seen before, and it was told to me it's hairy bittercress. And, you know, it's the seed, and you brush your hand over the top of the plant, the seeds just fly all over the place, like, you know, a spray of seeds and so forth. How do I get rid of that? I've never had that before. It's supposed to germinate in the fall and then send up the shoots in the spring where the seeds are. And so now that the seeds are ripened, they fly all over the place when you brush your hand across them.
Yeah, the bittercress are another group of the fall germinating annuals in the cabbage family. And your description of it is exactly accurate. And then it flowers in the spring, and then it produces seeds. And then you scatter them around. They scatter by themselves, animals, whatever. And so being an annual, it won't come up now. It'll sit in the soil. Being a fall germinating annual, the seeds will sit in the soil all summer, and then they will come up next fall. It requires, generally speaking, these fall germinating annuals need open soil. So if you have open soil, that's their habitat. If you have vegetation that completely covers the soil, perennial vegetation, like a perennial garden, a prairie, or whatever, the bittercress, the yellow rocket, all of these fall germinating annual members of the cabbage family should disappear over a period of a couple of years, depending on the situation. So it's going to respond to its opportunities, and the opportunities are open soil. So if you can eliminate the open soil, you should be able to get rid of your hairy bittercress organically with no herbicides.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Neil DeBull, our guest today, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Spending some time talking about weed control and prairies and prairie plants today with our guest, Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. You can join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And speaking of Facebook, Kara sent us a photo of a very nice plant, beautiful looking plant. What do we got here?
We have a lovely spring ephemeral native Wisconsin plant called Shooting Star. Mm-hmm. Dodecatheon media. It's a member of the primrose family, one of the few members of the primrose family that grow in Wisconsin. And this is a fascinating plant, because it grows in prairies and it grows in woodlands. Oak savanna type woodlands.
Yeah.
Not heavy shade woodlands, but where you have oak hickory forest where it gets light in the spring. And it does its thing in the spring. Blooms right now. It just finished. There might be still some plants still blooming, depending where you are. And then it produces seeds and it goes dormant usually by the end of July. And a lot of people think, oh my God, my shooting star died. But in fact, it only works half a year. It's got a contract where it only has to work a few months and it does its thing. It's a very slow growing plant. If you're growing it from seed, it usually takes 5 or 6 years to get a flowering plant from seed. So it's much slower than your average native perennial, which usually takes 3 years, maybe four. Shooting star can take 5, 6 or longer. But it's amazingly adaptable. It grows in what we call our dry lime prairies. These are prairies on limestone and dolomite on really dry sites, like a lot of them over on the Mississippi River in southern Wisconsin. It also grows, again, in rich oak woodlands and in surprisingly dry gravelly woodlands as well.
Yeah, this, I see an oak leaf there, so it's...
Yep.
On the bottom, and the flower is pretty. That's a nice specimen Kara's got there.
It's a gorgeous plant, and the flowers often are usually white, but there are pink-tinged ones. We have some that actually are almost, not red, but a very deep pink, so there's quite a bit of variety in the flower color. Mm. So that's a great plant. It's very easy to transplant in the fall, but if you dig the plant up, while it's growing, even after it's just emerged, if you don't have a big clump of soil around it, you run a severe risk of killing the plant. In the fall, if you want to propagate it, you can dig up a mature plant and you can cut off the individual roots. Most of the roots are about 5 to 7 inches long. You can cut the roots off and put them so that the top of the root is 1 inch below the soil. Again, do this in fall, September, October, when the plant is dormant. And the next year, you'll get sprouts from every single one of those roots.
So my goodness.
Yeah, so one shooting star might have 10, 15, 20 roots. You can get 10 to 20 new plants just by cutting it off. Now, it's going to take 3 or 4 years for that plant to reach maturity. But it still shortcuts the whole process of growing them from seed, which is quite a challenge.
Let's turn to Dan in Eau Claire next. Dan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Certainly. I appreciate that. I wanted to put in a good word for Creeping Charlie.
Okay.
I'm surrounded here in the middle of Eau Claire by homes that have wonderful lawns. I have a Creeping Charlie yard, and it's totally Creeping Charlie. Two benefits. One, I don't have to mow as often as they do, but more importantly, I'm the only one in my neighborhood who has bees, birds, and butterflies all the time.
Yeah?
The flowers and the Creeping Charlie. And I just manage it so it doesn't pester their their lawns. And I just think it's a wonderful plant if you take care of it. It also means, as I said, I don't have to mow as much as they do.
Well, it is one of the first flowering plants of spring, and so, you know, there are a lot of insects that can use Creeping Charlie, Neil.
Yeah, and it's a super low-maintenance ground cover. So, and, you know, a lot of people don't like plants because they want a certain look in their yard.
Yeah.
Like in my yard, I love the dandelions. I love the violets. The Creeping Charlie is a pain in my vegetable garden, so it's kind of a problem for me. But you're in that application, Dan, you're absolutely right. And you can save a lot of time and effort and not have to use any chemicals if you have the appropriate kind of ground cover like that. And, hey, more power to you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Jeff in Chilton, your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Neil and Larry. Hey, I've got a big patch of sumac that I have wood chips underneath it, and I planted the wild ginger plugs from Prairie Nursery, about 36 of them, about 5 years ago. So they're starting to form nice clumps. And I had put some hostas in about 2 years ago, and I got a couple of stragglers of the bishop's weed, the variegated bishop weed in there. Mm-hmm. So that's starting to grow in there, and I'm wondering if the ginger will be able to compete with that, because obviously that stuff is growing pretty fast. And then also in the last couple of years, I've got a little bit of start of the yellow toad flax in there. Are those two things, the toad flax and the bishop's weed, something that the ginger can compete with, or am I going to have to keep pulling it out to help the ginger propagate?
That's a really good question, Jeff. I've never put those guys up head-to-head against each other. But I think, bishop weed is certainly going to give your ginger a run for the money, that's for sure, because they both utilize a rhizomatous root strategy to spread. So I can't answer that. I think you have a good test case here, and I would suggest that you document this and paste it on the Garden Talk Facebook page so we can all learn from your experience.
Very good.
The wild ginger apparently is allelopathic, and it prevents the growth of most other plants once it is established. But at the interface between the wild ginger and the bishop's weed, it's kind of like the Maginot line. I don't know who's going to win that battle. So, and I don't know about the yellow toad flax either. I've never put that up against wild ginger either.
Yeah, there we go.
Sorry, I can't help you with that one. But we'd be very curious to find out what your results are.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you for calling. Becky in Fairchild has a question. Hi, Becky.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
We have a relatively new house. It was put up kind of on the edge of a wheat field and half in the woods. And I've been trying to get some gardens going, and I've got a 50 by 100 vegetable garden, too. And there are raspberries coming up everywhere. Raspberries and wild blackberries. And they're really nice in the patches in the woods where they can stay and I can go pick them, but in my lawn and my garden, and not such a nice thing.
Yeah, not so much fun. Okay.
No, raspberries are no treat if they're in places where you don't want them. And the strategy of raspberries is that they spread by creeping underground rhizomes, like so many of the problem plants that can plague people in their gardens. And not only do they creep by spreading roots, the stems will arch over, and where they touch the ground, those ends of the stems will re-root also. So it's like a hopscotch plant. Mm-hmm. And so it can go 3-4 feet just by arching stems, getting a new foothold, and that will put down roots. How to get rid of it? There's three or four different ways you can do that. If it's in a lawn situation, you can just mow the lawn. And this is a plant that will respond negatively to mowing because you'll eventually deplete it of its energy. If it's in a garden situation, obviously you're not going to be mowing it. You can go out and simply dig them out, but that's problematic because you think you've got the whole root, but you have to track all the rhizomes that emanate from the point where the stem meets the ground, where the main root is. They'll send out all these rhizomes that are very, very difficult to find. So you can dig the main root out and then try and track all the rhizomes that emanate out from it, and then come back after they resprout and find the ones that you missed and then dig those out. So it's a fairly long process. Some people resort to herbicides, and you can use two different types of herbicides. You can use a brush killing herbicide like triclopyr or Garlon 3A. Or if you want to use just regular Roundup, you can kill the genus Rubus, which are the raspberries, blackberries, dewberry. You can kill them with Roundup, but you must wait until after the plants have flowered. If you spray them in the spring before they flower, it will not kill them. The leaves will fall off, but it will not translocate down into the roots and kill the entire plant. So you have to wait until the plants have flowered, so you're not going to be able to use Roundup on them until probably July, August. But that will kill them. But, of course, Roundup kills everything, so if you have other beneficial plants there, you'll also kill them as well. The triclopyr and any broadleaf brush-killing herbicide will be specific for broadleaves and flowers. It will not kill grass when used according to directions, but it will kill broadleaves and most flowers.
Hmm. There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Speaking of Roundup, someone posted up on Facebook, and I'll see what you get your reaction to this. Actually, Sue says, here's a recipe for an organic Roundup. No need to use glyphosate. And she says, vinegar and Epsom salts dissolved. And there's more, I guess. But, oh, she also says, Dawn dish soap and table salt. That's it. Then spray over weeds.
There are many formulations that do not utilize glyphosate or other herbicides. And the vinegar concoctions and Epsom salts, etc., usually are quite effective on annual weeds and sometimes biennial weeds. The areas where sometimes they are not as effective as you might want is on perennial weeds, especially rhizomatous perennial weeds, where you have an extensive rhizome system underground. And these concoctions will not always necessarily translocate all the way down into the root and kill the plants. Now, I'll be honest with you, I don't have a lot of experience with this particular recipe here, so it may very well be effective on more intractable weeds. But most of these recipes usually are very effective on more shallow-rooted plants, which include mostly your annuals and your biennials. But when you get into well-established perennials, sometimes they are not quite as effective. And I'm not saying that everybody should go out and use Roundup, but there are some situations where it's so difficult, or any herbicide.
Yeah.
There's some situations where some weeds are so difficult to control. You can't dig them out. You can't mow them to death. I mean, there's all these different parameters that make it very difficult for some select group of weeds to be controlled. But hey, if you don't have perennial rhizomatous weeds, hey, I'm in. Sounds great.
What about these, we got about a minute here, these parasitic wasps and attracting them? Why would we do that?
Parasitic wasps are great members of the garden. And people think of wasps and think, oh my God, I'm going to get stung. But you look at how many wasps actually sting you. The biggest culprit, of course, is the yellow jacket. And yellow jackets will just as soon sting you as look at you. And if anybody's ever gotten one in their Coke can and got a sting in their mouth, I got that with a donut once. And then when the yellow jacket stings you inside your mouth, you...
I got one in a Coke can.
Yeah, there's nothing worse. Nothing worse. Or you step in a nest and you get 20 stings all over you. And some people, of course, are deathly allergic to them.
But these parasitic wasps...
The parasitic wasps are usually very small. You don't even know they're there. And they attack all sorts of other critters. There's a parasitic wasp for just about every insect, for every spider, for every tick, for every mite, and for every ant. I mean, it's just amazing. There are parasitic wasps that will take them down by attacking either the adult, the eggs, the larva, or the pupa. And they help to control populations of all these different pests in a garden.
So hang on to those parasitic wasps. Visiting today with Neil DeBull. Neil DeBull is president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. Our guest for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at weeds a lot today on Garden Talk. Larry Mealer here. And talking prairie plants as well with our guest, Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. All our lines are filled. Lots of questions out there. You can join us at when there's an open line at 1-800-642-1234. Hope you'll give us a call. And email us at ideas@wpr.org or post a photo on the Larry Mealer Show Facebook page. Post your question there as well. Neil, just before the news, we were talking about parasitic wasps. And anytime, you know, most of us hear about, oh, wasps, I'm going to get stung. But that's not the case with parasitic wasps.
Not with parasitic wasps, because they don't attack people. They attack other invertebrates, particularly insects, as we talked about, and ticks, mites, all sorts of other critters. So what they do is they usually will lay their eggs. The female will usually lay their eggs on the body of a larva. They may actually insert the legs into a larva, the eggs into a larva, or place the eggs around another group of eggs, like in an ant colony, or in some cases on a pupa, in some cases on the adult, but rarely. And so these eggs will hatch, and then they begin to devour the host insect or tick or mite or whatever. Usually, in almost every case, killing it, but then their larvae grow and become adults and then start to cycle over. So the great entomologist at Harvard University, E.O. Wilson, calls the Hymenoptera, which includes bees, wasps, and ants, he calls them the little things that make the world run right, because these are the natural controls, and it's the parasitic wasps that really do this work. And so there's enough of them out there constantly keeping everything in check. And so it really prevents any particular insect, good or bad, from getting out of control.
So what do we do for, what plants can we do, or what can we do to encourage?
You can plant a diversity of native plants and specific ones that are particularly amenable to the parasitic wasps. And I'll tell you a story. I had a client who had a vegetable garden, and he had terrible problems with tomato hornworm. And he planted a 1,000-square-foot prairie seed mix from Prairie Nursery, quarter of a pound of seed. And when the flowers started blooming in that prairie mix, all his tomato hornworm problems went away. because now he had a diverse group of native flowers that were supporting all sorts of pollinators and parasitic wasps. And he had one plant in particular called Rattlesnake Master, Oryngium yuccifolium, and it's in the carrot family. And it is particularly attractive to parasitic wasps and many wasps.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a wasp that attacks the larva of the tomato hornworm.
Uh-huh.
And it lays its eggs on it, and then the eggs hatch and burrow into the tomato hornworm larva and then eat it from the inside out. And then they literally come out of the skin of the caterpillar, the tomato hornworm caterpillar. Just like the movie Alien.
Oh, man.
He didn't think they made that up, right? No, they got that from nature. So this is just one example of how parasitic wasps keep things in control. So you might have a few pests, but these parasitics will keep them under control so they don't get large populations that can devastate your garden or whatever, and other plants. So they're really an important strategy for organic gardening. And more organic gardeners are planting prairie plants or prairie garden or prairie meadow near their gardens for natural insect control so you can get rid of the pesticides. And here's the most important thing: if you're going to garden with a prairie, throw away all your insecticides. Don't throw them away. Take them to a recycling place. Get rid of your insecticides. Quit using them because they kill all the good guys with the bad guys. And if you look at insects and other invertebrates, 98% of them are either beneficial or neutral.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only 1 or 2% that cause a problem. You know, it's like that kid in fourth grade that's always getting in trouble and the whole class has to stay after because of him. I think I had something to do with that once. So you get rid of the insecticides and you can restore the balance of nature in your garden and hopefully never have to use them for any control problems. I can't guarantee you it's going to work on potato beetles. I still have potato beetles. I have almost no insect problems in my vegetable garden. I mean, really, the only thing I have is potato beetles. I don't know what the heck eats them birds. So you have to go out there and squish those potato beetles. That's no fun.
Well, let's see what's on Ron's mind from Grafton next. Ron, hi.
Hey, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. And Neil, thank you for your knowledge. Have you tried a pie pan of beer to get those potato beetles?
No. Oh, to get the adults to go in there?
Yeah. I mean, I've tried that. It works.
I know you can use that for slugs. I didn't know you could use that for potato beetles.
Okay.
Will the adults go to the beer before they lay eggs on your potatoes?
Well, I thought that's what you were talking about, the slugs.
Oh, no. These are those nasty potato beetles, those orange potato beetles, and then you go out and pull them off.
Well, if you try the beer and it don't work on those, you can always drink the rest of the beer.
That's what I do. I'm going to drink a beer and go smush those potato beetles.
my question deals with moss. I have it in some areas that I like it. It's like walking on a carpet.
Yeah.
But then in some areas, this stuff spreads, and I'd like to get rid of it, but I don't know how.
Sure.
I do use Roundup, but I don't like using it, a lot.
Sure, absolutely. Let me ask you a couple questions. Is this a shady area, Ron?
Yes.
Okay. And what's your soil type?
I would say it's a lot of sand.
A lot of sand.
Drainage.
Okay. Where are you located? You're in Grafton? Okay.
Yes.
Usually when you have moss dominant in a situation, it's usually an indicator of an acid soil. Not necessarily, but often. It also is usually an indicator of low nutrients in your soil, which is very common in sandy soils. And so what they call higher plants, flowers, grasses, etc., have difficulty growing there. And the beautiful thing about mosses and lichens, which are related to mosses in some sort of way, is that the waste products of mosses are highly acidic. And so it's a self-reinforcing cycle. When a moss colony becomes established, it acidifies the soil further. Sandy soils are particularly easy to acidify because they have a low buffering capacity, unlike clays and loams. So the soil can become increasingly acidified by the exudates and waste products of the moss. So it's self-reinforcing. So if you want to get rid of the moss, first of all, you have to remove it. And then you would probably want to lime your soil. I would suggest that you test your soil and test your soil for pH, for phosphorus, for potassium, calcium, and magnesium. You can test it for nitrogen too, but nitrogen tests it doesn't tell you that much usually. It can help a little bit. But then you can amend your soil with organic fertilizers or whatever you want to do, and probably with lime or dolomitic lime. If you're low in magnesium, you would want to use dolomitic lime because dolomitic lime has a high magnesium lime. So that will now get your soil back in balance where it can support other plants. And then you can install transplants. Is it a large area or a small area, Ron?
It's a fairly large area. How long would that take before I can plant grass seed then?
Well, you're going to run into a problem planting grass seed if it's shady because most lawn grasses don't grow in the shade. Now, we do have a product called our No-Mow Lawn Mix, which will grow in moderate shade. Mm-hmm. The only issue with that when you're growing lawn in shade is that you have to remove the tree leaves that fall on it in the fall, or else they will smother the grass. So there's an extra added maintenance requirement if you're growing turf in the shade. So I think that's going to be another issue here, is that the shade factor may be such that it's going to be very difficult to grow a lawn. Bluegrass and perennial rye are out pretty much for sure.
Yeah.
But the fine fescue, like our No-Mow Lawn Mix, will grow in shade. It does great on sand, but you're going to have to control the moss situation first. And if you're going to lime the soil, you need to till that in about 6 inches deep prior to seeding.
Well, okay.
Okay.
All right. So a little bit of work ahead of you there.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it, though, because it will be outside on a nice, hopefully warm day.
Yeah, why not?
All right.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling, Ron. We have Tammy in Madison next. Hi, Tammy.
Hello. I just want to comment about, and thanks for taking my call. I want to comment about some of our invasive plants in our yards and our prairies that are actually edible and quite delicious. For instance, Virginia waterleaf, the flowers and the leaves are edible, and you know that plant is very aggressive. Vicious goutweed, garlic mustard, creeping charlie is even edible. You can make a tea with it.
So there's lots out there that you can eat.
Yeah. Absolutely. You can come have all my garlic mustard. You can make garlic mustard pesto out of it. absolutely right. And I eat some of these, not all of them. I mean, what I really enjoy is this weed that gets in your vegetable garden, and it forms a big rosette, purslane. It's super high in vitamins, and it's kind of like eating snot, but it's not that bad. But it's really nutritious, and you put it in salads, and I probably shouldn't have said that, but it's kind of gelatinous and mucilaginous, but it's really good in salads. And of course, lamb's quarters, the leaves of lamb quarters when they're young are very good. And if you want some a little more lemony flavor, you can get the leaves of curly dock when they're first coming up. And cattails are very invasive in situations. You can eat the roots. I don't really care for cattail roots that much, so Native Americans certainly ate them regularly. But yeah, you're absolutely right. There's all sorts of different plants. But if you want to make some garlic mustard pesto, come on over to my place. I got plenty of that I'm fighting. So.
Okay. Lori in Green Bay, thank you for calling.
Hi. Some lady had called earlier about creeping charlie, and I decided to Google that and find out that's what I've got in my yard that the bees just loved. I had dandelions and some kind of very prolific violets, and they wouldn't touch them, but they went right to that. So I thought, well, maybe I'll just keep them around. Of course, I didn't know what it was at that time. This is only my second spring in the house that I'm in now. So what are some good spring perennials that can compete with this so I could get rid of that? Because I just end up mowing it down anyways with the rest of the lawn. But my other question is, I have the most beautiful blue-eyed grass that I've ever seen. It's really lush and thick and lots of flowers on it. I got it from a greenhouse in Green Bay, of course. And I want to plant that in a line between some sedum. And is the sedum going to overpower that? And can I mow the this little blue stem or blue-eyed grass?
I don't know if that blue-eyed grass is going to be compatible with the sedum because of the spreading nature of the sedum.
Oh.
Blue-eyed grass is a short-lived perennial. It usually doesn't last much longer than 5 years, and it relies upon self-seeding for it to propagate. So is this a sunny area, or is it a shady area that you're looking at here, Laurie?
Oh, very sunny.
Very sunny. Okay. Mm-hmm. And what is your soil type?
It's sand, but I'm not sure pH or anything.
Okay. So a blue-eyed grass is a pretty delicate, short plant, so it doesn't do well with a lot of competition. You normally see it in grassy meadows. Is that where you're seeing it on your property?
This is actually from a greenhouse.
Oh, that's right. Of course. Yes, you planted it. Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't like too much competition because it's short, and if you have a lot of taller plant material around it, it will tend to shade it out and outcompete it. So it does need the open, lower structure of competing vegetation. The sedums, you might be okay, but those sedums are going to creep and crawl all over the place. So I would give it its own little spot if you can.
Okay.
And then you had you were talking about the bees on your other plants.
Yeah, the creeping Charlie. Yeah. They loved it.
They love it.
And
absolutely.
I would normally just mow it down, but because there were so many bumblebees on it, I thought, well, I'm going to keep that. That was before I knew it was creeping Charlie. But what other early spring perennials could I have for the bees?
Oh, there's tons of different spring perennials. Are you looking just at bees or for a wide variety of pollinators?
I guess for everything.
Okay, I can give you a few.
Yeah,
really
sure.
Good.
Why not?
Okay, now it will depend upon your soil type. But this is for shade now, or is this for sun?
Sun and sand.
Both.
Okay. Well, we could be at this for a while, so I'm going to give you the cliff notes here. In your shade, and you need to check the pH. Okay, you really need to check the pH because some plants are very sensitive to pH.
Okay.
If you have an alkaline soil or not a particularly acid soil, the shooting star that we talked about earlier is an excellent spring ephemeral. The bees go crazy on it. Bloodroot is another great plant. Now, this is for shade. The shooting star will grow in sun or shade. It needs a pretty decent soil, and it does need an alkaline pH of 7 or higher. The bloodroot is a little more flexible, but it tends to like an alkaline pH as well. For the shade, the large flowered trillium, our white trillium, is heavily visited by bees and flies. Here's another thing that people don't appreciate. I'm not talking house flies. I'm talking native flies. This is another terribly underappreciated group of pollinators. So you've got flies and wasps, which are hopefully someday going to be appreciated as much as bees finally are being appreciated. And 25 years ago, I'm telling everybody, you got to plant wildflowers for the bees. And they're saying, oh, but bees sting. Well, now we've gotten past that. Now people want bees. Now we have to get people to understand that the native flies and wasps are a very important part of the ecosystem and very important pollinators. So as far as other spring flowers, the baptisias, these are the false indigos. There are big, tall ones. They get 5 or 6 feet tall, the white and the blue false indigos. And then there's the shorter cream false indigo, which gets about 2 feet tall. These are going to start blooming here very, very soon. So and these are heavily visited by bees, especially bumblebees. You've got wild geranium, which grows in sun or shade and is a very, very adaptable to a wide range of situations. You've also got Jacob's ladder, which is another great pollinator plant. Grows mostly in shade, but half a day of sun as well. If you have really dry sand in full sun, you can plant the wild lupine. And this needs a really, really sandy soil. But it has beautiful spires of blue flowers. And if you live in central Wisconsin, you may get lucky and be able to support populations of the federally endangered Karner blue butterfly, whose larva caterpillars depend exclusively upon the leaves of the wild lupine. So these are just a few. But you can go to our website at www.prairienursery and find all sorts of wonderful wildflowers that will be suited to your specific growing conditions. And we have a plant finder function where you can type in your soil, the sun, the color, the height, all these factors, and it will then give you a list of plants that meet those parameters.
Yeah, very, very cool. Thank you, Lori. And again, it's
prairienursery.com.
Com. Yeah, there we go. Thanks again for calling. We have, Kathy on Facebook says, is this a Canada thistle? And I think she's right.
Kathy, that's a Canada thistle. And you can tell by the fact that it has basal leaves that are not very large. If you look at our other thistles, they're mostly biennials, like the bull thistle and the nodding thistle. They tend to have large basal rosettes. The Canada thistle has much shorter leaves, usually not more than 5 inches long, whereas the other thistles have leaves that can get up to a foot long. But the real distinguishing characteristic is that long white taproot that you pulled up. And you got about 6 inches of taproot, but that root will go up to 18 inches deep, and then it has side lateral taproots, and they creep and crawl all over the place, which is why Canada thistle is a federal noxious weed, and that's rare territory because I believe there's only 8 federal noxious weeds. So it's really, really hard to control because of those deep taproots. So good luck with that. It's a tough one.
Yeah. Here we've got another photo on Facebook. Who wants an ID? Phil wants an ID of this plant. It looks like a...
Oh, boy. Well, it's a grass or a sedge, and there's not enough to go on there.
There's about
60 candidates for that one.
And, here we have some Japanese knotweed.
Yeah, Japanese knotweed. That's nasty, nasty stuff.
And if you want to see a photo of what Japanese knotweed looks like,
don't let that get started.
Yeah, it's up on our Facebook page, and you know he wants to know how to get rid of it.
Oh boy, that's really tough,
Tony.
Most people I know, like people in the Nature Conservancy who deal with this on their properties, they use the nuclear option. They use herbicides, specific broadleaf herbicides, to kill this. Roundup doesn't kill it. It's got dense root systems, and you have to use repeated applications. So you have to go to the heavy artillery to get rid of Japanese knotweed, unfortunately.
Let's go to Gene in St. Louis, Missouri. Gene, hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, hi. I'm actually in Hales Corners visiting my mom. Neil, we met when you were a guest speaker in St. Louis earlier this spring.
Oh, yes, yes.
And so fun to hear you in your home state. I wanted to share a little thought about the emotional connection that we have with the environment that native plants create. When I grew up in Muskego, all the hedgerows and all the roadsides and all the edges of farmers' fields were all filled with so many different wildflowers, spring, summer, and fall. And now we know those are, you know, they're diminished, and we're having to replant milkweed for the monarchs, et cetera. And in 2001, I was up in Evelyn, where my family is from, with my grandma, and we were visiting a recreation of a mining village. And I stepped off the little tram out into this field of wildflowers, and I smelled the smell of summer in my childhood. And it was so distinct, and it was like a bell going off in my feelings, giving people the opportunity to make those connections with those smells and with those sounds of insects and with that liveliness. That's so important for us, for our health and our culture.
Gene, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think we are a much poorer society for our continued loss of wild places and natural habitats. And that's why I've spent 40 years of my life doing what I do. And I just hope that I've been able to help other people achieve this. I think you're so right on. And I just hope that we continue to increase the restoration of native plant communities, because I think we're losing them faster than we're restoring them.
Yeah.
Well, it's very fun to hear your expertise up here in Wisconsin. And the big thing I learned from you when you were speaking with us in St. Louis is about the difference between rhizomatous and tap and shallow-rooted plants. So now I know what I'm dealing with when I get the rhizomes, and I'm able to manage them better.
Excellent. Excellent. Good old plant ecology. Never fails you. Thanks so much, Gene. Those are really wise words. Thank you for sharing
that. Happy summer.
Yeah, happy summer to you as well. Thanks so much for calling. Well, Neil, I've got in front of me a copy of your plant catalog, and it's an ecological gardening guide.
Yes, we try and pack a lot of information in our catalog. I've said, since I've been doing this for 35 years, we have three products at Prairie Nursery: plants, seeds, and information. And so we try and pack lots of information in both our catalog and our website so people can use them as a resource for learning more about gardening with native plants, so they can be successful in this process and create these really attractive and ecologically sound lower maintenance landscapes that supports all forms of life on our planet.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you with us, Neil, and we will look forward to another visit from you. You're a busy guy right now?
Busy guy right now.
Yeah. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry. It's always a pleasure to be here with you.
Neil DeBall is president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. His website, prairienursery.com. You can take a look at it there. And just let me tell you that Scott Royce joins us next week to talk about all things in the garden. UW Extension Horticulture Ag Agent. And it'll be a pleasure to have him with us. Pleasure to have you with us. Stay with us.